6:13 on a foggy Wednesday morning. It got heavier just since I drove in about an hour. So if you got any fog reports, you can safely text in 504-260-1870. As I said earlier, the Crescent City Connection brightly lit up in pink lights, and I can see it from the corner of Poydras and Magazine, which is not that far away. And when I drove in, the fog was kind of lifting up from the bottom to the tops of the buildings in the CBD and looked really Halloweenish, like they had a smoke machine or something going on. But either way, be careful. Warm today and tomorrow and through the next several days, highs in the lower 80s. You heard Peyton Malone say it's going to be a warm Halloween, but dry, bone dry, no rain at all, and the tropics are quiet, and we're just about through hurricane season. David Schultz joins us now, professor of political science at Hamline University. Good morning, David.
I'm doing well, and I hope you're doing well today.
We are. We're just about through the presidential election as well, less than 2 weeks away, early voting underway. Have we been able to glean anything? Do they do exit polling on early voting or not?
They do not do exit polling. The only thing we do know at this point is that unlike 4 years ago, where Donald Trump was discouraging people from his supporters from doing early voting, this time there seems to be some evidence. If you look at areas where the votes are coming from, it's looking like Republicans are coming out and voting early also, too. You know, but again, it's not an exact science right now. We're basically kind of what we know what happened from geographic areas from 4 years ago. But early voting is up across the country because I think people kind of like the idea of what? Early voting and not standing in lines on Election Day.
According to Louisiana Secretary of State, of the people that have voted early, so far, 37.5% have been Democrats, 34.6% have been Republicans, 27% other parties, 3,019,000 overall. In the first 3 days, it was 38% Democrats, but 45% of early voters were Republicans, 15% other parties. And it's interesting how, look, candidates change their opinion all the time. If you're on their side, you say they revised their strategy. If you're against them, you say they're flip-flop, and that happens all the time. Candidates say one thing, then another. But right. When it comes to former President Trump and railing against early voting, now saying get out and vote, it seems as though he's made that transition seamlessly with his followers.
It does seem like he's done it, and I think this is a smart move for him, as well as it would have been for the Democrats, too, because what you basically want to do at this point is lock those votes down as much as possible, because if you can get Smith or Schultz off the vote and they've already cast the ballot, I don't have to worry about Smith or Schultz now. I move on to Jones, et cetera, and worry about getting them out to vote. And I think that's, again, so Trump, I think, learned the lesson from before. And also, this might help him even more so on election night, because if he's got the day of election voting, and some states they do count the early votes, not all of them, it might help him in terms of where he looks on election night. Because remember, 4 years ago, he was ahead in several states, but then they had to wait to count all the early ballots. And so I think this is in part a way of trying to mitigate some of that, too.
I don't understand the French fry thing at McDonald's. I don't know what that was trying to do. Am I missing something or not? And I'm not trying to criticize the former president. I just don't get it politically, the strategy of what that was supposed to show.
Well, what's really become interesting in American politics is how geography, voting, and marketing, you know, the products that we buy, reinforce one another. And there was this really fascinating article last week in the Washington Post that pointed out that if you look at how the Trump campaign is spending money for, like, where they go to eat, where they get food or pick up coffee versus the Harris campaign, McDonald's was a great dividing line. Republicans go to McDonald's, they go to Dunkin' Donuts, Democrats go elsewhere. Everybody seems to go to Starbucks for coffee. But, you know, but I've been talking about for years how you tell me what kind of car you drive, you tell me where you go to eat, you tell me the clothing that you wear, and I can make nearly perfect predictions about how you're going to vote. So the McDonald's, for some reason, McDonald's has become Republican.
See, that surprises me, because you would think Republicans, no disrespect to anybody here, I'm going to get everybody angry by saying this, David, but you would think, generally speaking, correct me if I'm wrong, Republicans are more educated or not?
Now it's become Democrats flipped it. It used to be 20 years ago, college degree was a great indication of voting Republican. Now it has shifted, where one of the big divides in American politics is if you've got some college education or graduated from college, much more likely to vote Democrat than Republican. That's, you know, versus 20 years ago, if you were working class, you were much more likely to vote Democrat. We've just about flipped things. And this is happening before Trump, by the way. It's not just during Trump. But this is one of the flips that's been occurring in American politics. But what surprised me about the McDonald's is that, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong here, I kind of thought McDonald's was kind of universal American, you know, that that everybody goes to McDonald's or something like that. So, I don't know. I mean, it's just kind of interesting. So I'm thinking it reinforces his support with Republicans because they're saying, well, yeah, I go to McDonald's. I like eating a Big Mac. President goes there. He serves fries. Yeah. Okay. I like him. I can bond with him. Huh. I guess that's the logic.
Well, somebody texted in, and look, I've seen the meme about him fixing the ice cream machine and so forth. I get that. But somebody texted and said it was a, it was a publicity stunt, get a sense of humor. I have a sense of humor, believe me, but I just know politically back in the day, when you look at Michael Dukakis with the helmet and the tank, right?
And
John Kennedy, even, they gave him a hat in Texas and he said, no, I'm not going to put that on because you didn't want to be photographed in anything foolish as a presidential candidate. But now it seems as though dressing up as a fry cook at McDonald's is something that you do want to be seen as. That's all I'm trying to say here.
Yeah, and that is the part that's strange now. It's just the sense in which I think, what's the phrase from years ago? I want to be able to go out and have a beer or a cup of coffee with the person who's the president. And again, it's a sense of bonding or identification. Again, nothing against people who work at McDonald's, but I want my qualifications for president more than the fact that I can just, I can say, do you want fries with that or something like that?
Other thing is that, to be clear, he didn't work a shift at McDonald's. This was staged. They had the audience, the drive-through window was pre-selected because they got security concerns and everything else. They tried to kill a guy twice. You're not going to have him working the drive-through window at McDonald's with anybody that drives up. That's common sense. But do people think that he was actually really working a shift, or do they realize it was a staged event?
In a world right now where people can't seem to separate fact from fiction, I think some people will watch it and say, oh, yeah, okay, so he showed up there. But even if it's not, again, it's about creating images. What was that commercial from years ago? Was it, I don't play a doctor on, I'm not a real doctor, but I play one on television or something like that, for whatever product it was, something like that. I think that's sort of what it is now. I'm not really a fry cook, at McDonald's, but I'm playing one for the purposes of this ad or something like that. That's really, I think, this blurring of fact and fiction.
Maybe I'm old and curmudgeonly, but it just seems stupid to me. I don't care if Kamala Harris had done it. It would just seem stupid. It's like, really, we got so many issues with debt and deficit in this country, with inequalities of income, with Social Security. That's going to be the difference maker on who you vote for, whether or not you serve fries at McDonald's, really. And that's not against former President Trump. I don't care who would have done it. It just seems like, what's the old thing? We got serious issues, and it's time for serious discussions, not this kind of foolishness. But I guess it's politics. 6:22, more when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 6:26. Well, apparently this McDonald's thing has elicited a lot of emotional responses from people about how she didn't work at McDonald's. She did work at McDonald's. I don't know what McDonald's is saying about it. I worked at Firestone back in the day, but I worked for a long time, not for a couple of weeks. So I still, I got, I guess, some documentation of that. Not that it would make me a more fit presidential candidate. How big of an issue is this just a more sizzle to the steak, or is it sideshow? Tell me, David, how much of a big deal is this?
At this point, it's probably just noise. I mean, think about it. Is that with less than 2 weeks to go, I doubt there is any mind to be changed in America. People have made up their minds. Maybe the only debate is, am I going to show up to vote, or do I want to say, a pox on both houses and stay home or something like that? But I think this is just a lot of noise right now. And there's all kinds of indications that, from a lot of research that's been done, that especially at this stage, that the few people who are undecided, they're not paying attention to stuff like this. They're just not paying attention.
Let me read you a couple of texts. One says, work ethic. Trump has it, Harris not so much. It's pretty obvious. I think people ignore the fact that Trump started with how many million dollars? That he's somehow crafted this story that he's a guy that grew up shoveling cement, and that's not the case at all, but people believe it. I don't know. Kamala Harris, I don't know what her background is, but I do know Trump from a long time ago was born rich. So somebody else saying, so you're saying that people who work at McDonald's are stupid. Trump is at McDonald's to show he's for the working class people. Well, I guarantee you this same person would not be in support of a minimum wage raise for people who work at McDonald's because they would say that that's just an entry-level job, right?
I think you're right on that score here. Yeah, I mean, to me, the McDonald's story will become, like I said, the noise, a distraction. It'll like with all your callers or texters like this point, it's going to elicit a whole bunch of sort of reaction. But at the end of the day, it's just not going to change anybody's minds about anything.
Let me clean this up, David, if I might. I said 3 million people voted earlier. I misread the data that somebody sent me. There are 3 million registered voters.
Okay.
That's not accurate at all. 350,000 people total have voted, not 3 million. I want to clean that up.
All right. So anyhow, my point being is that we have a lot of noise, and especially with all we voted at this point, these stories, they're just not going to affect people.
Man, the people that love Donald Trump, you better not say anything. You better not even mention his name without saying in the name of the Father and the Son and Donald Trump, or else they're going to jump all over you. There is something about this man that resonates with people.
Yep, I think he's got a charismatic authority in the sense that people just love him personally. Remember, he caught it 8 years ago. I could stand on Fifth Avenue, shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose support. His supporters are with him, for good or for bad, and I leave that up to the supporters to make their own decision on that.
You know, the old thing, and I'm going to go a minute late here, they say, you know, the old saying about, I don't know what it is, but he has it. What is it?
Uh-huh.
What is it about him that resonates with people so much?
Well, I think in part it is, Well, first off, it's the fact that the other two parties are the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. They're not speaking to working class America. There's just no question about that. And they're not talking about the issues that I think that are important to them. So I think by default, when he comes around and says, listen, I'm the anti-establishment candidate, at least 8 years ago, there was some appeal to that. But remember, he's been president now. He's been president for 4 years. And I think it just comes down to at this point that he speaks it about some frustrations and anger that some of his supporters feel on a day-to-day basis.
And the texts come in about Kamala Harris pouring in about lying about working at McDonald's. Well, former President Trump, with all due respect, has been known to stretch the truth as well. So, but that doesn't seem to matter so much. It's amazing to me. Thank you, David Schultz. Appreciate it. We'll take a break, come back, talk about Governor Landry's tax plan right now. A minute late, time for WWL First News. 6:46, 14 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL. The fog has lifted and moved behind the Crescent City Connection, so I can now see the pink lights beautifully lit up. Stephen Procopio joins us now, president of the Public Affairs Research Council. Good morning, Mr. Procopio. I'd like to welcome you to testify before this committee. And right now, sir, I'd like to remind you that you are under oath, and I would have to ask you, are you now or have you ever been an employee of McDonald's? I'm just kidding. How you doing?
Good. I've never been an employee of McDonald's, but I worked for Pizza Hut for a while. So I
would remind you, sir, that you are under oath talking to this committee. Let's talk about Governor Landry. And I would remind you that I worked for Firestone busting tires as a kid. And I envied you guys that worked at Pizza Hut and grocery stores and everything else, because it seemed like a lot easier work. Let's talk about Governor Landry's tax plan. What did the Public Affairs Research Council look into, and what did they find?
Sure, and it was a partnership with both us, Committee 100, and Cable. So all three of us, we really wanted to look at, okay, how we know the tax plan, we're going to move to a flat tax, and we're also going to, on sales tax, start to tax services and digital services. And so what was going to be the effect on households? Like, was this going to be regressive? Because I think a lot of people, including ourselves, were concerned this might affect poor people more.
Let me jump in for 1 second, Stephen, because you're throwing some terms around. Let's start about flat tax and regressive, just to start with, and what that means for people that might not get it.
So our flat tax, right now for income tax, there are three brackets. So if you make up to $12,000, you pay 1.85% of that income as taxes. And up to $50,000, you pay 3.5%. And then over $50,000, you pay 4.25%. So depending on the income you're making, that gets taxed at different levels. A flat tax means there is one rate, 3%, is what the governor's proposing, no matter your amount of income that you're making. So, and generally, a flat tax by itself is considered regressive, because then, you know, people at the higher end spectrum aren't paying as much as people at the as they were before. But in this particular proposal, he's also the governor's also proposing to triple the standard deduction, so from $4,500 to $12,500, which makes a big difference in terms of making sure it's not regressive. Regressive meaning it disproportionately hits people from lower and moderate incomes.
What effect would that have on the economy of Louisiana?
Now, that is another big picture, and I can't answer that. We can only pay Greg Albrecht so much money. That was the economist that we hired. It used to be the economist for the Legislative Fiscal Office that would write fiscal notes. We didn't have enough time, and we didn't particularly ask him about that question. We were really more asking him, how is this tax plan going to hit people of different incomes, is really the focus of what we did.
So how are we defining, I guess, lower incomes or the poor? And I guess what effect would that have on people? We got this information, but what does it mean, I guess, what I'm asking you, Stephen?
Sure. I mean, to get to the end question, the spoilers, that actually this, what they're proposing, actually is slightly more progressive than the current system. The way they're structuring it and the way the standard deduction is that for income tax, actually people that are poorer or more moderate income will actually tend to get the biggest benefit from the tax cut. That's not to say that everybody, and that's in terms of percentage of a cut. So you're looking at something along the lines of a 40% cut for those people, for an individual making $50,000 and what they're paying in income tax. Now, in terms of absolute dollars, if you're a millionaire and you get a cut, even if you get a smaller percentage, you're still going to have a bigger absolute dollar cut. So you're looking at something on the lines of like a $3,000 cut if you're making $500,000. And if you're making $70,000, you're getting a $500 cut. But as a proportion of income, it's actually better for the lower and moderate income. And I'm talking in the, you know, basically anything up to about 80% or $80,000 is getting a good deal. And it goes down from there. So that's on the income side. So it's actually just about everyone's getting a pretty sizable income tax cut. And then on the other side is sales tax. On sales tax, there's a whole bunch of things. There's about a half-cent sales tax that was going to roll off. Mm-hmm. As part of their plan, they're going to keep that on. They're also going to expand to various services like car washes, personal services, not attorneys, not legal services, but like delivery services, lobbyists. Lobbyists are going to get hit with a tax. So you hire a lobbyist, you got to pay a sales tax. Also, the digital goods, like video streaming, like Netflix, digital games, Candy Crush, and then subscription services. A lot of people don't buy computer programs anymore. You essentially rent them, mm-hmm. and you would be paying a sales tax on that.
All right, let me take a break.
We also had a concern. Sure.
We'll pick it up there. We come back. You also had a concern, yeah. All right? Remember where you were. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Stephen Procopio, president of the Public Affairs Research Council, about Governor Landry's proposed tax plan for Louisiana. 651 traffic now, WWL. Wednesday morning, October 23rd, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Stephen Procopio, president of Public Affairs Research Council, about Governor Landry's proposed tax plan and what they've who's this Albrecht guy? I don't have it in front of me.
Greg Albrecht.
Greg Albrecht did an analysis of it and said that it would be more progressive than the current system. You said you also had a concern about what, Stephen?
Oh, wait, no. So that's on the individual income tax.
We also have
on the sales tax as well.
Right.
Because there's going to be expansion of sales tax to digital services as well as personal services as opposed to like actual goods that you buy.
So is that going to hurt any group more than the other?
At an income level, not really. It will help. It will actually hit higher income groups a little harder because they're the people that tend to buy more personal services, have delivery services, lawn care. So it tends to hit them a little bit harder proportionally. What we don't know, and we didn't really get an answer on this because we were looking at people, is how it will hit business, because there's a lot of services here that might hit businesses. And so I can't tell you how it will hit large versus small business. So that we still is an open question. In terms of families, it will be less bad for those that are have less income, and it'll probably hit those people that use these services harder in the sense that they're buying more stuff. It's one rate for everybody, but the people that have more income tend to use personal services more as to buying like physical goods.
So I see Alan Seabaugh, who is about as conservative can be, saying that it seems like a good idea, but the devil's in the details. I see Democrats saying, I don't know if they can support the plan. Well, what does Parr think about this? Is there enough information out? Is there enough time to vet all of this? Because the devil is indeed in the details.
I absolutely agree. And that's part of why we did this study, because we know that the fiscal office is going to come out, the legislative fiscal office is going to come out with notes that tell us how much all these things cost. But we were concerned that, you know, how this is going to impact families of different income might get lost in the shuffle. So that's why we did the study. I do think there's still information we got to go through. I think it's becoming clear what's going to happen with the income tax and the sales tax. I know businesses are diving into the corporate tax. So I think this is becoming clear every day. But, you know, there's still a lot of questions to be answered. How is the constitutional amendment? They're going to have a rewrite of Article 7. There's still a lot of information to kind of go through there. And now that we've got this tax report out, that's probably what Parr is going to turn our attention to.
So what is the next step here? Is there going to be a special session or not?
I have heard that there is. It's just a matter of when exactly they're going to call it. They're going to call it on like the 7th, so they're going to call it the 11th. I don't know. But I'm pretty sure we're going to have a special session.
Thank you, Stephen. Appreciate your time and the information, as always. Stephen Procopio, president of the Public Affairs Research Council. When we come back, we're going to talk to Leslie Harris. She's been very involved with finding housing for homeless people that are in homeless encampments. And Louisiana State Police has a plan to close New Orleans' largest remaining homeless encampment this week. Because of the Taylor Swift concert, it set off a political firestorm. We'll get her take on this when we come back. Then we're going to talk to the chief economic development officer of the Downtown Development District about Swifties and their descent on the city and what that could mean economically. So a lot coming up. Stay with us. Tommy Tucker, WWL. All right, 7:15 now on this Wednesday morning, October 23rd, a warm, dry week ahead. Next 10 days, really. Halloween, if you're expecting that first real cold front of the season, like a lot of us do on Halloween, not going to happen, not according to Peyton Malone, WWL Louisiana local, your weather forecaster. We're getting ready to talk about this move by the state police at the behest of Governor Landry, as I understand it, to clean out this homeless encampment and kind of push him down a couple of blocks because of the Taylor Swift concert. They also have erected a black metal grate around Donkin Plaza, which is supposed to be a rideshare area for people before and after the concerts. And I guess this brings up a question of how do you establish priorities here? Super Bowl, long way away. Taylor Swift concerts, not so much. So Councilmember Leslie Harris, whom we're waiting to speak to, tried to slow down this effort, and I think she got the state police's attention because the captain himself said that it would be not a real good thing to scatter people around before they had a place to go, especially if they were sitting on homeless vouchers or vouchers to get themselves housing. So we'll try to figure out what's going on here with all of that. I would ask you at 504-260-1870 to respond to this text. And somebody from, I'll just give the last four digits, 6758, says, Leslie Harris wants to, quote, feed the strays. The result will be more problem people flocking to New Orleans. Most local governments do not have problems with mass homeless. Never feed the strays. And I don't know if this person goes to church or not, but these are human beings we're talking about. And are you really reducing them to strays? With that, Leslie Harris joins us now, New Orleans City Council member. How you doing, Leslie?
Hey, Tommy, how are you?
I'm okay. Sorry, somebody texted in, you missed this, and said, Leslie Harris wants to feed the strays. The results will be more problem people flocking to New Orleans. Most local governments do not have problems with mass homelessness. Never feed the strays. I got to remind this person, these are people. This is not a stray animal or something here. Your response to that, and I guess as the that response and the way some people feel about homeless people?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're getting. We're getting people who, unfortunately, see homeless people as not human and not as who they are, which are our neighbors and our family members. We've talked about this before. A lot of the people who are living out in the encampments are New Orleanians who have lost their homes because of high housing prices, high insurance costs. There are a lot of domestic violence victims out there who are escaping predatory partners. There are children and women who are living in cars out in the encampments. So to call people strays is dehumanizing, and exactly why we have to have a strategy of housing folks out of the encampments and not just sweeping them under the rug. The other thing that I'll say is this. We are one of the few cities in the state that have a strategy for closing the encampments and getting people housed. Jefferson Parish doesn't even have a homeless shelter. So there are a lot of people who are coming from across the state to New Orleans because they know that we have resources here. Do I think that's a problem? Yes, because other parishes should have a strategy that's similar to ours to house people, to make sure that they're not falling out of housing, and to get people into safe and clean housing. So sure, there might be people coming from other parishes, but that's only because those other parishes don't have the resources that we're trying to muster.
And somebody else texted in, feeding the strays is exactly what Jesus did every day. So I'll pass that along as well for people that maybe go to church on Sunday and then don't carry it with them throughout the week. What exactly was the effort by the state police? What did they do on Monday and day before yesterday, Leslie? I'm a little bit discombobulated here. What did they attempt to do, and tell me where we are now?
So what we learned sort of Friday and over the weekend is that there was a meeting that was had whereby the governor would have the state police go out and give notices to people living in the encampments and in the French Quarter that they would have to move. When I saw the state police out there, and Nate Fields, who's the director of our Office of Homeless Strategies and Services, met with Troop NOLA, the Commander Hyatt saw the efforts that were taking place that were successful. We walked the encampments with him, and he said, "We see that your strategy is working. We see that the Calliope encampment, at least, has been shrunk because of our efforts." And that he would try to get the governor to back off of doing a sweep, which would literally just push people into neighborhoods and onto private property. Once people are on private property, it's very hard to do outreach. We know that. I get calls about it because people will say, well, I have permission. And, you know, we have a lot of property that is blighted. We can't find the owners, and therefore you can't determine whether or not people have permission or not. It's very hard for the city to go onto that property. So the Commander Hyatt saw the efforts and said, hey, we will try to back off of the intention to sweep these encampments. Now, whether or not and what's going to happen, we are waiting to see what the governor is going to do after talking to Hyatt. So we're really in a waiting pattern. But we are at the ready to help folks to try to get them emergency shelter if that's what it takes. But what we can't have, again, is for a all-encompassing sweep that just really does nothing and has no plan behind it and just pushes people into other neighborhoods and other places, because that's exactly what will happen if there's no plan to get people shelter.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Leslie Harris, New Orleans City Council member, 721 Traffic Now, WWL. All right, 725, Tommy Tucker, WWO. Quickly back to Leslie Harris, New Orleans City Council member. Somebody texted in, Leslie, and I don't know if they are aware of your or familiar with your history with working to house the homeless or not. They are postulating, and I'd like you to address this because, you know, they might speak for thousands of people. Who knows? That this is just because the state is doing this and you didn't have a problem when the city cleaned up the encampments, but explain the difference, what happened logistically between these events?
Sure. So what the city has done really since Nate Fields has been in our city, we created an Office of Homelessness Services and Strategies. And with Unity and Travelers Aid, we have done targeted outreach to people living in the encampments. And so what you're seeing the city do is strategically close encampments, but we're actually housing people. We're getting people into housing. So there was a great article on NOLA.com that did an interview of some people who have been housed from the encampments. We're putting them in apartments and homes, getting them caseworker and case management, making sure that they have food and furniture, and getting them off the streets with services that surround them and bolster them so that they can live, rather than doing what the governor intends to do, which is sweeping the encampments and closing them and not providing shelter for these folks. So there's a huge difference with what the city has done, and we've housed almost 600 people since the beginning of this year, versus sweeping people away into neighborhoods and not having a plan for them after the sweeps. Many of the people who are in the encampments right now have vouchers and are just waiting on a landlord to take those vouchers to get them into safe housing. So again, there's a huge difference between what the city has done, which is systematic decommissioning of the encampments, getting people housed with services surrounding them, versus sweeping the encampments.
So with that being said, this is a huge event for the city. This Taylor Swift thing draws worldwide attention.
Sure.
How do you balance having a safe environment and a clean environment for the people that are visiting for Taylor Swift with the homeless encampments in the short term? Should this have been done before? Thoughts, et cetera?
Well, we have a plan to end street homelessness by 2025. This has been a publicized plan. Tommy and I have talked about it before. And guess what? Taylor Swift has visited other major cities like L.A. and San Francisco that have a huge homeless problem, and that, you know, those governments are not doing what this governor intends, which is just sweeping people under the rug so you don't see them. That is not a plan. That is literally displacing people who are already displaced from homes and just getting them out of the way for a three-day concert so people don't see them. That's not a plan. That's just inhumane, and it's just not real. And guess what? We need to have real planning to get people into home, get them on a bus to back to where they want to be with their families, and that's what we have been doing.
So, again, you would say that leave it like it is for this weekend with the Taylor Swift concerts? I'm not pressing. Well, I guess I am pressing. I'm just trying to ask.
No, I would say that, especially the Calliope encampment, where people, there's not drug dealing going on, and Commander Hyatt said that there's not a lot of predatory behavior happening. Just leave it as it is. Let us take care of it. Let us get those people housed. And we will continue on with the plan. But just displacing people, again, into neighborhoods where we can't find them and locate them and get them the services that they need is not a plan. It's not humane, and it's not the way to go.
What do you think happens from here as far as the state police and the governor's office?
I hope that they back off. I really do. I hope that they see that what we have done is working and that they let us be. If they wouldn't do anything, they can provide additional vouchers for homes. They can provide additional caseworkers. And if they want to help, they can provide additional funding for the plan that we have going forward. And we've asked the governor for that. We haven't gotten it yet.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. Leslie, it is 7:30. We'll come back and talk with Renee Pastorek, Chief Economic Development Officer for the DDD, about the effect of Taylor Swift and the Swifties on a downtown economy. Right now, time for WWL First News. 7:46, 14 till 8. Weather should be perfect for Swifties roaming all over New Orleans. A big deal. This is a worldwide event, really. I don't think people realize this. And I was listening to, well, first of all, it's Tommy Tucker, WWL. I don't know if I said that or not. But, you know, Newell was talking about, it's not to be negative about it, but when you think about this Taylor Swift phenomenon, that it was the target of a terrorist attack, and we'll talk about the security aspects with Ronald Surpass after. The only reason I say that is that this is more than just a concert. This is a big, giant deal. And with that, as the context, Renee Pastorek joins us now, Chief Economic Development Officer for the Downtown Development District. Good morning, Renee. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about this Taylor Swift series of concerts. Selling out the Dome 3 days in a row, that's an accomplishment.
That is huge, you know, and like you said, one thing that people who aren't familiar or fans of Taylor Swift really should understand this is an international phenomenon. We're going to have people coming from around the country and potentially around the world to come for 3 days of sold-out concerts. Most concerts, when they come to New Orleans, you know, they might be trying to hit the larger regional market up to Baton Rouge, to Biloxi. This is really pulling people from around the entire globe.
Tell me about the Swift lift to the economy, because we're going to talk to Mike Haas in a little bit over at the Superdome about what's going on at Champion Square and people lining up to buy merchandise already. What kind of lift is this going to be for the city economy, for the downtown area, et cetera?
So this is going to be incredible for downtown and really the entire city. So you mentioned three sold-out concerts. That's 50,000 people per night, 150,000 attendees, many of them coming from outside the city. The U.S. Travel Association estimates that Swifties are spending about $1,300 in the local economy when they come to the Eras Tour. So that's about $195 million generated into the local economy. Something else to think about, too, you know, you have restaurants, organizations, venues around the city hosting Taylor Swift events, specials. And what that's really going to bring, in addition to those people coming to the concert, is people without tickets, myself included. My family, you know, we have brunch reservations on Saturday just to come downtown, spend money, and see the hoopla, you know, all around the city. And you're going to have plenty of people doing that who just want to be near the event.
Let's talk about some of the, well, first of all, things don't just happen, right? And if you got kids, allow me a little bit of latitude here, Renee, if you got kids, you realize when it comes to volunteering at schools, et cetera, things like setting up chairs, and I'm not trying to be stupid here, but things don't just happen. There takes a lot of people working behind the scenes. It takes a lot of preparations. And unless you're ever involved in something like that or involved in the preparations, you don't get that and you don't realize that. With that being in mind, talk about some of the preparations that the city has made for the Swifties, for the concerts, including things like ride sharing, right?
Yeah, so especially because we're planning to host the Super Bowl in just a couple of months, the Taylor Swift concert has really acted as a kind of preliminary deadline to getting a lot of things in order. Certainly, you've seen, if you've been downtown, Poydras Street, it's fully reconstructed. The striping is set to be done relatively soon. There's no planned traffic closures in advance of the concert. All streets will remain open. There are some potential closures that may happen, you know, as crowds thicken. But NOPD, all the public safety officers are all hands on deck. We're bringing in, you know, help from the state and federal resources as well. So public safety, certainly. We're no stranger to hosting events. That's one of our greatest assets. With respect to transportation, rideshare, you know, one thing that is being tested in advance of the Super Bowl for the Taylor Swift concert is rideshare pickup at Duncan Plaza along Gravier Street and Perdido. So this is going to be a new pickup point that will really streamline rideshare services in partnership with those rideshare entities. And again, serve as a testing ground for the Super Bowl, which would go through the same thing. I do want to mention in Duncan Plaza, the city's also hosting a free festival with all sorts of food and music running throughout the length of the weekend. So people waiting for their rideshare or just people who want to be downtown, there'll be plenty to do in that area.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Renee Pastorek about the phenomenon that is the Taylor Swift series of concerts. Is there a name for it? Swift Mania? What are we calling it, Renee?
Come up with a name.
Swift Lift. Yeah, we'll come up with a name. We'll call it the Swift Weekend or something like that. 751 traffic now, WWL. 756 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Renee Pastorek, Chief Economic Development Officer for the Downtown Development District. I'm sure I did not come up with this. I'm sure I heard it somewhere. But let's go with Swifty Graw. What do you think, Renee?
I love it.
Yeah.
I'm here for it.
But again, I'm sure I didn't come up with that, just so nobody accuses me of stealing anything. Let's talk about the ride sharing. And somebody texted in about pedicabs and the logistics of all of these people trying to leave the dome or get a ride share. I guess one thing that is in New Orleans' favor is, and it also helps for the Super Bowl, is the proximities of hotel to the concert venue, right?
That's right. You know, I think if you can walk from your hotel I would definitely do it. There's going to be a lot of traffic, a lot of people who may be going to, you know, outside locations using rideshare. But that really is one of the best things. You know, I actually traveled to Europe over the summer for the Taylor Swift concert with my family.
Did you?
And I'll tell you that there is, even in another city, like, there is no city that does events like we do in New Orleans. When you see New Orleans and company and their, you know, mantra that we're built to host, we really are. And I think that I've seen that. And what I'm excited about this concert is that, you know, you see these restaurants all around the city. You see people who are going to be walking straight into the Dome for the concert. It's really going to brighten downtown for a 3-day period. Everybody's going to just be in a great mood. And it's just really exciting for the city.
Years ago, I can remember going to Pat O'Brien's when we were hosting one Super Bowl or whatever it was. And I didn't buy a drink because the fans from both cities were buying drinks for people. And the only reason I bring that up is that when it comes to Swifties and the fans, are they I presume you guys have some analysis of the people that come in for the shows and everything. They spend a lot of money, don't they?
They do. You know, and the age demographics that Swifties will be is every, you know, she's been around for 20 years. This is everybody from millennials down to parents and kids down to 6 years old who are coming in for this concert. So, you know, you're going to have people who are willing to put down money at restaurants, at retail. Something else to bring up, too, is that, you know, our hotels are 100% occupied for this event.
Wow.
It's 3 nights of shows. So people coming in from out of town, they're coming in for one night, maybe another night if they've bought extra tickets, but they're going to be exploring the city those other times. Like I mentioned, you know, when I traveled for the Taylor Swift concert, I went there for the concert but turned it into an entire vacation. So you're going to have people for 3 nights of shows doing that around the city.
And this phenomenon, they like to hang out with each other, right? I don't mean that pejorative by saying they, but it's like even if you're not going to the concert, Swifties like to hang out with Swifties, which makes it kind of like a Super Bowl with fans, even if they're not going to the game, just one big party. Am I accurate with that, Renee?
That is 100% accurate, and you'll find that at many of the events. You know, I know there's a Taylor Gate event at the Benson Tower just outside the Superdome. A lot of the restaurants are going to have friendship bracelet making events. That's something that they do at the concert. They share bracelets. There's photo ops. I think at Canal Place you can take a selfie. They updated their little living wall with a Taylor Swift quote.
Thank you, Renee. All right, 8:15, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Ronald Surpass, as we are most Wednesday mornings. He's a professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, head of the Nashville City Police, Washington State Police, well-accomplished, started as a foot patrolman, then went on to motorcycles and horses, then head the department, et cetera. How you doing, Chief?
Tommy, I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm okay. You know, I was listening to Newell yesterday, and I forgot about this, that this Taylor Swift thing, that actually was the target of a terrorist attack that led to, or not a terrorist attack, a planned terrorist attack that led to the cancellation of some concerts in Europe, I think it was. And tell me about the security concerns when it comes to an event like this.
Well, you know, Taylor Swift, yeah, absolutely. Taylor Swift is a big draw. Believe it or not, the WWE was a massive draw when I was there. It's 70,000 people. So whenever you have that many people in a dome, football, basketball, whatever, you have to plan how people are going to get in. You have to plan how people are going to get out. You're going to have to plan how the officers can quick respond if something changes. Tommy, you might remember when we did the Super Bowl in 2013, I was the chief, and we were sitting in the dome when all the lights went out.
Oh.
And immediately your mind goes to, how can we get 70-plus thousand people out of here in an orderly fashion? Well, chances are it's not going to be very orderly. At least push people, hopefully, in a direction that's safest for them. Then you take collaboration with local, state, federal. If there's any threats outstanding, you would probably have some federal collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, it's a local and state jurisdictional issue. And I got to tell you, you know this, and you hear me say it all the time. The New Orleans Police Department is the finest crowd control, crowd movement police department in the world. I still think that to this day. I'm here in Boston at the Police Chiefs Conference and talking to police leaders from all over the world, 34,000 members, 171 countries, and everyone says, how do y'all do that in New Orleans?
Mm-hmm. Are there really Dunkin' Donuts on every corner in Boston or not?
Well, they must be avoiding them from me, I can assure you, because I didn't see a one.
Really? Let's talk about the crowd control aspect of this. Is a Mardi Gras crowd the same as a Super Bowl crowd, the same as what we anticipate to be a Taylor Swift crowd when it comes from the law enforcement standpoint?
You know, Tom, that's a great question. On the one hand, it's really not much different at all. It's just a different place and time of where they're going to be. But what's different with Mardi Gras, for example, is that's now probably 11, 12, 13-day event where a concert's in and out one usually. But as far as the people, the preparation for a concert at the Dome, which is so brilliant at doing this for the last 40 years, they can put together a concert quickly in and out. They know what to do. The officers, the private security, they understand that traffic pattern of pedestrian and vehicle. But when you think about a Super Bowl, those are multiple-day events now, multiple days to prepare, multiple days of parties, the day of the event itself, and then multiple days to take it apart. Some colleagues and I are doing some work to help some cities around the world that are dealing with Olympics, dealing with World Cups. And in those cases, you have massive numbers of people with long-term implications of players living in villages, right? The Olympic Village, staying there for weeks and weeks on end. So they all have a little different angle, but at the end of the day, you want to hopefully prepare well so that people can have a great time and not get agitated and go home.
I know this is 3 days of concerts and a full house each night. I guess the same as, what's the sold out capacity of a Taylor Swift concert? I don't know if it's 70,000 or not, maybe 50, but either way, it'd almost be like three Super Bowls, maybe in a way, back to back to back. How does that change the equation, Chief?
More time on task. You know, you know the NOPD struggling with staffing, according to them, and I believe them. The Louisiana State Police doesn't have the biggest arm of support, but they'll be supporting. The Superdome has its own security force. And then the Superdome hires off-duty police officers. Primarily, one of our captains has been doing it for a really long time and does a tremendous job. So this particular captain knows the inside and the outside of the dome, knows exactly where the pinch points will be, where the problem points will be. So I would think it's going to go very, very well.
Do they do, as part of crowd control, do you do, like, analysis of crowds from other cities from where events? Because, I mean, Super Bowl, we've been through it. We pretty well know what to expect, although I don't know, as I ask this question, if it goes to what teams are playing. Is a San Francisco crowd tending to be more rowdy than a Baltimore crowd, than, a New Orleans crowd for their home team?
You know, that's a wonderful question. I've been the leader of two Super Bowls, and my distinction in the crowd would not be much, right? If people are coming for their team, they're going to be fired up. I've not had the benefit of leading a Super Bowl where your home team, which I think might have some differences, right? It could very well. You'd have more maybe people who are going to be on the street with or without tickets because they could just drive from, you know, the Ninth Ward and come down and hang out downtown. So that's a good question. I don't know what the answer is, but Tommy, let me share with this again. I'm with the Police Chiefs Conference. We have 34,000 members, represent 171 countries, and people ask us, the NOPD, how do you do these crowds day in and day out with little to no issue? And we share a lot of our trade secrets, if you will, about how to get it done. And the trade secret is this: treat people with dignity and respect. Recognizes one police officer, you can't stop five people from doing what they want to do. You have to talk about it doing what they want to do.
Let me pick it up here when we come back, talking to Ronald Surpass, Professor of Practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief at the, what'd you say, Chief Police Chiefs Conference?
Yep, our annual conference. We're in Boston this year.
And I heard Ann Kirkpatrick talking to Newell yesterday. She said all hands on deck here. I would presume she's here and not there.
Likely, if I was in her position, I'd have been back by now as well.
Yeah. All right, we'll take a break, come back, and talk to Ronald Surpass, 821 Traffic Now, WWL. 826 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Ronald Surpass. I said, Chief, that you were actually one of the few people taller than Taylor Swift, who clocks in at 5'10", and when you put the heels, would be even taller than that. You're what, 6'7"?
I'm 6'5", but imagine if I wore heels.
I would rather not, but thank you. Thank you for putting that in my head. Let's talk about this. And you, man, I'm telling you what, you listen to Newell Norman, you learn some stuff. You ever listen to Newell?
I do. Man, Newell is a very dear professional and personal friend.
Yeah, you can learn some stuff listening to that guy. Anyway, he was talking about the plot in Vienna with the Taylor Swift Eras Tour. And if you know, you got to be a pretty big act to draw it, I would think, your own terrorist attack that's planning on killing tens of thousands of people. And I don't say that lightly. I'm just thinking that's a serious deal. When it comes to an event like this, Chief, talk about as much as you can the coordination that happens, because this has to be not just with FBI. This has to be, I guess, CIA and everybody else, right?
When you're talking about international activity of any star, not just Taylor Swift, there's very popular people all over the world that maybe even more popular than her. And terrorists seek to change the way you feel about your safety, the way you feel about your economy, the way you feel about your people. So whoever they choose to attack, it's more so about changing the way you feel as opposed to demonstrating any injuries, which is obvious. Mm-hmm. If it's an international thing, you have what's called Interpol. You have police agencies. You have FBI. They call them LEGATs. You have FBI offices all over the world. And it's in the best interest of the world to stop these kinds of things, because the ultimate goal of much terrorism activity is to disrupt your daily life for weeks and months and years after the horrific event, right? That's a much different question than just the horrific event itself. They want people to be afraid. They want people to lose faith and confidence in their government to make them safe. Therefore, their form of government or their view of the world makes people safer. So it's a constant battle of essentially good versus evil. And that requires collaboration of countries, nations, police forces, United States military forces. And it's done, you know, fairly well. We have these incredibly horrible events like October 7th. We have other horrible events. But we also have a media process, fair enough, that doesn't report, hey, everybody, today went good, no attacks. You don't see that every day, so it's not their fault. It's just not what's going to happen.
You know what? Let me say something here before we run out of time, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I saw a story the other day about a police department that enforced a warrant, and they were at the wrong house, and somebody was arrested for pulling a gun and shooting at the police, et cetera. And I was just thinking that happened. But what you don't see news stories are of the thousands of time each day that warrants are successfully served. And I don't think that's fair to the police departments. Thoughts?
And I have a saying for our audience. If you are criticizing the police, you have a right to do. We are hiring. Come do our background investigation. Come through our 6-month training academy. Come through our 4-month experience being FTOs. Come through working through a consent decree police department. Come work on a police department that's doing the right things. We're hiring. Come work with us and see what happens.
I think everybody just needs to keep that. When you see a story like this, you need to keep in mind, okay, that's the anomaly. That's not what happens all the time. Thank you, Chief. Safe travels. Go find a Dunkin' Donuts, will you?
I'm on it.
And a nice pair of heels. Ronald Surpass, Professor of Practice, Department of Criminal Justice. We come back. We're going to talk to Mike Haas out at the Superdome about things going on with Taylor Swift. We'll also talk to our friend Bob Iback. And more time now, WWL First News. All righty, 844, 16 till 9. We're talking to Mike Haas in a little bit over at the Superdome about the Swift mania that's happening, what's going on at Champion Square about getting you merch. But first, speaking of merch, we talked to Bob Iback with Nyko Sports about this 100th anniversary LSU football that people are, man, talking about, excited about. How you doing, Bob Iback?
Hey, Tommy, nice to be with you again. And I know since we spoke, that big win this past weekend, I'll tell you what, the Tigers are on a roll. I was talking to you after the Ole Miss game, the overtime one, and then of course they won at Arkansas. Now they got to go to Texas A&M. They are in the process of really having a historic season.
And let me tell they are in an ideal position, because the expectations are not where they were with Jaden Daniels, or given the defensive problems, or with Joe Burrow, but man, that defense is getting better and better every week. This could be a very special season, I'm telling you.
Well, I think you're right on about that, because we're ranked ninth now. They got to make it into the top 12, eighth. And I certainly think they got a chance to do that. Of course, the A&M game on the road, and then you got home against Alabama. So the next 2 weeks are going to be important. But, you know, we were talking the last time about this LSU 100th anniversary season. It's a salute their historic stadium, which is ranked number one in the country. It's the most prolific stadium, I think, that I've visited in my football career, covering college football for many, many years.
This is a great-looking football, Bob. I got to tell you, I'm looking at it right now.
And then there's something that we start out, Tommy, you know, with 2,024 of these. We're raising monies for the Cox Communications Academic Center for student-athletes. And we're down just a few hundred left, and I wanted to get in touch with you this morning to let your audience know, makes a great Christmas or holiday gift idea for that Tigers fan. And every football, they're priced only at $119.95. You'll get a numbered certificate of authenticity. I will give out that phone number in just a second, but I want to point out a couple cool things on this football, because all the panels are embossed, which means it'll keep it pristine looking. Tommy, I've had some of these footballs made by Nyko Sports 10 years ago, and they look like they just came out of the case that were sent to me. They keep it that fresh looking for many years to come. Now, on the top panel of this football for the 100th anniversary, we've got the stadium, the 100th anniversary stadium logo there, stadium facts. The second panel right below that has Tigers football history, their championship history, right next to a beautiful LSU helmet logo. And the third panel is my favorite one, Tommy, because it was a color panoramic photograph taken out of a helicopter a couple years ago of Tiger Stadium, and it stretches from left to right on that third panel and gives you a beautiful look. It was a sun-drenched afternoon. It really pops out on that football. So if you'd like to get this 100th anniversary football to salute, I think, the best stadium in the country for the Tigers, we only have a few hundred left. Do this soon because it will sell out. Here's the phone number to call today. It's 1-800-345-2868. Let me repeat that. 800-345-2868. These are $119.95 each. You could also go to the website and order it there, nikosports.com, NIKCOsports.com. That's NIKCOsports.com. And when you go there, check out some of the football cases that they have, because you may want to pick up one of those as well and put that football in a place where it can be displayed in your home or office. I will guarantee you, I've got several from LSU things that we've done together before. I get people coming to my man cave and they say, "Where did you get that?"
Well, this you go with the mahogany case on this. This is mantelpiece stuff. This isn't man cave stuff to me. This stuff you put on a mantelpiece in a living room, especially if you're an LSU family and an LSU household. That panel with the picture of Tiger Stadium, they have managed to capture in one picture the essence of Tiger Stadium on a Saturday night. And that's hard to do, really, but they did it.
Well, I've covered some games down there over the years in my sports career, and I never, ever, pass up a chance to see a game down at LSU, because it's just amazing. It's an amazing arena. It's an amazing stadium, whatever you want to call it. But you get 100,000 people or more in there, and you get the Tiger Band down there. It's a happening.
And it's the kind of thing, this ball, that you get this for Christmas, you give it to somebody, they realize as soon as they open it, they got a keepsake that they're going to treasure for the rest of their life. And I'm not overhyping it. I'm serious. When you look at this thing, it's beautiful.
Oh, it is. And it'll appreciate over time. I've done a lot of memorabilia work in my career, and I've seen items that, really go up in value. For the price that you're going to pay, $119.95, you will get something that will only increase in value in years to come.
And you don't have to get the case, but I would suggest you do, because it's perfect, man. I'm telling you, it looks beautiful, that mahogany case. Anyway, take us out, Bob. How do you get it? And one more time, where do you go and what do you call?
Sure, it's the 100th anniversary football for the stadium. And we have two ways you can get it. It's $119.95. You'll get a numbered certificate of authenticity. Everything is fully licensed. It's approved. And a portion of the proceeds will go to the Cox Communications Academic Center for student athletes. The phone number to call to order these, and we only have a few hundred left, 1-800-345-2868. Again, that's 800-345-2868. And Tommy, you can go right to the website. You can see it there. It is special. NikoSports.com, NIKCOsports.com. Don't miss out on a chance to own something that only 2,024 folks will ever get a chance to own.
I am ordering one as soon as I get off. Some factoids on there about the Tiger football program, about the stadium. It's a keepsake. It really is. Thank you, Bob.
Tommy, it's always special. Have a great day now.
You too, sir. Go to NIKCOsports.com or you can call 800-345-2868. Go to NIKO Sports. Just take a look at this thing. You'll see what I'm talking about. 850, we'll talk to Mike Haas when we come back. Traffic. All right, 856, 4 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. A lot going on today over in the area of the Superdome. You got the Pels tipping off against the Bulls, getting the NBA season started tonight. We'll have the action for you here on WWL. And, of course, in case you haven't heard, Taylor Swift is going to have some concerts at the Superdome. Mike Haas joins us now. How you doing, Mike?
I'm well. How are you, Tommy?
I'm all right. Let me just say this before we get to Taylor Swift, and I tell people this all the time. You are really missing out if you don't turn down the sound on TV and turn up. You and Deuce and Jeff Nowak, y'all do an extraordinary job. You and Deuce play well together. You compliment each other. Deuce has forgotten more about football than I'll ever know, and you paint a picture of the game, and you do really do. I enjoy the broadcast, Mike. I just want to tell you that. You're a pro's pro, and I
greatly appreciate it.
I mean,
a couple of victories wouldn't hurt.
Yeah, the only thing.
A couple of victories wouldn't hurt.
The only thing I don't like is that the Shahid, see you later, bye, I think you'd maybe sent him to the emergency room with that, and that's not what you're trying to do, right?
No, not at all.
All right, let's talk about Taylor Swift. What's going on today?
Well, today is the first day of merchandise sales. In fact, I'm standing in the line. I'm on Girard Street with about 75 people. You want to hear from them?
Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Say hello to Tommy Tucker on the radio.
Oh, my. What a reception.
Some have been here since, 5 o'clock.
Really?
So today is 10 o'clock to 8 o'clock. Champion Square. You don't have to have a ticket. Forget about it. Come on in. Get your merchandise. And 10 o'clock to 8 o'clock for anybody. And it's the same thing tomorrow, Champion Square, 10 o'clock to 8 o'clock. Anybody come get your merchandise. And then it changes a little bit. For Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you still go to the Smoothie King Center from 10 to 8. You don't have to have a ticket to get your merchandise. Champion Square, as you know, becomes a little different because you have to have a ticket to get in for your day. So at 2:30 on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, Champion Square opens up for people with tickets for, again, merchandise, and it stays open until 30 minutes after the concert. Pretty amazing. The point being, two keys here, that we are really trying to take care of a lot of people who are not going to the concerts, who don't have tickets, but want to come get the stuff. So we have a lot of opportunities for them. And secondarily, there's a lot of people that will be coming from out of town. And when we say, hey, Champion Square is the secure perimeter, mm-hmm. like a Saints game, doesn't mean much to them, but it does. When you come into Champion Square on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, you are in the perimeter. You can leave, but you can't re-enter. So keep that in mind. That's why we're pushing. Come get your merchandise early. Take it back to your hotel room and just enjoy the weekend.
Mike, we only have a couple of seconds here, but how extensive or how many to put the stage in and all that stuff for the shows? Was it a lot to be done at the Dome?
Oh, they're still doing it. It's
really?
Yeah, it's expensive, but guess what? This is what they do. They do it in other cities. Every city, it's down to a science. That's all good. And we start on Friday, but we have a lot of things going on before Friday.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate your time. And good luck in Los Angeles with the Chargers.
Oh, you bet, pal. We're going to get a W.
Thank you, sir. Hope so. Mike Haas, our friend, of course, the Pels tipping off against the Chicago Bulls tonight. That'll be here on WWL. We're going to talk about this whole dust-up with the Inspector General's office and a brew pub in Gretna when we come back. 9:17, we have made the necessary arrangements. Kim Chatelaine joins us now, Jefferson Parish Inspector General, to talk about the imbroglio involving this brew pub in Gretna. Good morning, Ms. Chatelaine. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Give us some background on this for people that might just be tuning in and didn't hear the initial conversation and don't quite understand what's happening here.
So back in September, our office released a public letter. And the purpose of that public letter was to pose questions and raise concerns to the parish council about their intention to use $10.3 million to give to a nonprofit to build a public building on public land with public money, but the building was going to be used for private gain, more specifically a brew pub and taco restaurant run by Port Orleans.
Okay, what is the nonprofit involved here?
The nonprofit is Jefferson Facilities, Inc., which is an economic development corporation.
Okay, so what does the law say about, and I'm not trying to cross-examine you, I'm trying to understand the way the system works. How did $10.3 million of public money get allocated to this Jefferson Facilities? What was the rest of it? Inc.?
Jefferson Facilities, Inc. And so what happened is, like, in about May of 2023, the parish council started passing these resolutions, which really, if you're the public, you're not understanding what you're seeing, because it started out with $34,000 to Jefferson Facilities, Inc. And then there was a resolution, we're going to approve the development of a multi-use building. And then there was like another resolution, well, let's give them $465,000. And so it was like a series of resolutions spread out over months. And then in October of 2023, which is what caught my attention, there was a special council meeting. And that council meeting, the only item on the agenda was approving two leases to Port Orleans to operate a brewery and a taco restaurant in a building that wasn't even built yet. And this lease provided, like, they didn't even have to pay rent. They didn't even necessarily have to operate. We were going to give them, but, you know, whatever. There's no public money involved necessarily. But the building wasn't even built. And then in December, after the leases were approved, the parish council gave $8.6 million to Jefferson Facilities, Inc. to build this building for Port Orleans.
So how can they say it wasn't, whoever said this, that it wasn't public money? I don't understand it.
I don't understand that either. You know, the Jefferson Parish was fortunate to get millions of dollars, a windfall to the parish on the other side of the pandemic. And instead of keeping that money whole, and instead of using that money in accordance with federal guidelines, what the parish did was they took the money in, they swapped it out for payroll, used payroll expenses to justify the money to the feds, and then took the money and put it into discretionary accounts for council members. So this is taxpayer money that got divvied up to the council because they washed through federal funds.
Where does the state attorney general come into this? What is she saying?
She, all I know is the statement in the paper, which is, you know, that that's under review and that she has questions about an investigation. We have not conducted any investigation yet. We're required to report out to external agencies such as the Attorney General whenever we find any issue that might be under their jurisdiction. So when we issued this public letter a month ago, we, of course, sent a letter to the Attorney General. I wasn't necessarily expecting the Attorney General to do anything one way or the other. We were just complying with our mandate to give notice.
What do you think is behind all of this?
We don't know yet. You know, we issued the public letter to literally raise concerns to the parish council to give them the opportunity and to empower them with information to consider seriously the ramifications of what they were about to do. Not what they had done, but what they were about to do. I get the impression they plan on plowing forward. So we're going to do what we do, which is we're going to investigate, we're going to follow the money, we're going to audit, and then we're going to issue investigative reports and audit reports.
So some stuff has been made about you and a relationship between, or at least a friendship between, I don't mean to imply anything at all here, about you and Councilperson Jennifer Van Vranken. What would you say to people that are saying there's some kind of conflict there or some kind of friendship or something? What's going on with that?
I think it's a narrative intended to disparage and detract from the facts that are in the public letter. If anyone could come forward, would come forward and say, you put this in the public letter, this is wrong, or you put this in the public letter and it's not true. No one is addressing the merits of the public letter. They are trying to distract. I met Jennifer Van Vranken. It's no secret. She came on ahead of me under Parish President John Young. I started under Parish President John Young as the first director of ethics and compliance. So we met each other at the parish 10 years ago. I've made what I thought to be good, positive relationships with a lot of other outstanding professionals at the parish. She is one of them, but it has nothing to do with how I do my job or, more specifically, the issues in this public letter.
So have you spoken to Liz Merle or anybody from your office speaking to her office?
No. No, I have not spoken with the Attorney General's office.
I'm just concerned or wondering how she got involved with this. Do you know?
Other than we sent the notice to her office, I do not know. I don't know if anybody else has picked up the phone and called her. I don't have the Attorney General's contact information other than what's on her website.
So let me go to this story by Blake Patterson here, a talented writer at NOLA.com. And it says, officials at the state, parish, and city level lambasted the letter, saying it failed to identify any waste, fraud, or abuse and unfairly cast the project in a bad light just weeks before groundbreaking. They also criticized Chatelaine's office for not interviewing anyone involved in the project before issuing the letter. Thoughts?
Thoughts. The letter identified past waste. The letter identified future risk of waste. So I think, very sadly, the conversations that I have had with officials at the state and local level, when I start the conversation, I'm not that far in, and I realize that they have not read the letter. So I'm having a conversation with myself about facts that I know, facts that they don't know, and yet they want to hold firm to specific opinions. So that puts me in a really difficult spot when you're having a conversation with somebody who hasn't done their homework.
You know, somebody texted it in, and I really do need to go back on this because, again, some people follow, some people don't. Where exactly is this that we're talking about?
If you're familiar at all with downtown Gretna, there's a big, big public parking garage that services the courthouse and government. And then there's the government building. This space is across the street from the main government building. It's next door to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. So we're going to be having a brew pub and a garage looking on to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals.
And what's there now?
A flat surface parking lot.
But you said we have a brew pub and a, what is it looking onto the Court of Appeals? A brew pub and a taco place? Is that what you said, or a parking lot?
Yes, they're going to be building a brew pub and a taco restaurant on the parking lot.
But when you said looking at the appeals, I don't understand what that's got to do with whether or not it's, what that's got to do with the Inspector General's office. That's where I'm confused. Because that seems like a judgment of what should be there, what shouldn't be there, as opposed to the process.
No, I'm just saying, like, if you're wanting to know where it is, that is physically where it's going to be located.
Okay. So I guess when it comes to precedent, are there precedents for other projects like this?
I'm not aware of any precedents of this nature. I am aware of public benefit corporations, public-private partnerships, where you can construct a public-private partnership, and the litmus test for whether it's a public benefit is that there's actually money coming back to the public. So other parishes have done public-private benefits with businesses where they get a return. Either it's a return by way of rent, it's a return by way of guaranteed employees. It's a return of some deliverable. In this particular case, we have no revenue being returned to Jefferson Parish.
So as it relates to Jefferson Parish, this is the first time anything like this has ever been done, as far as you know?
Well, when they built the garage, Jefferson Facilities, Inc. built the garage, it started out as a partnership where Jefferson Facilities, Inc. was going to build a garage, and the garage was going to be supported by the revenue from the garage. But as it turns out, the parish has picked up the full tab on that debt. So right now, we've paid for a garage in Gretna that we don't even own, and we don't see any revenue from that either. And that was part of the letter. In other words, I looked at what has been our past relationship with Jefferson Facilities, Inc., how have they performed? And let's look at that and see if we can learn something about how, what our risk can be in the future. And what we know in the past is they haven't performed for the benefit of Jefferson Parish.
So your concern is that Gretna is going to benefit from something if it goes good, and Jefferson Parish is going to be on the hook if it goes bad?
I'm saying we gave $10.3 million away. We're going to end up with a building that we're going to have to maintain, and we are going to see nothing for our $10.3 million. And that's waste.
Okay. Does Gretna, as an unincorporated area of Jefferson Parish, and when you say the parish is going to get nothing, and I'm not trying to get too far in the weeds here, but when you say the parish is going to get nothing, would they get a portion of sales tax or something that Gretna collects?
No. Gretna, the city of Gretna will collect sales tax. The state of Louisiana will collect sales tax. The parish of Jefferson is not collecting any property taxes because we own the property, we will own the building, and we're building it. So we are giving away $10.3 million, and we are not getting anything back.
Okay, so Joe Marino is going to be on next with me, and I'm sure he's going to have a lot to say about this. If he were to say, or what would you, I guess, your biggest concern about this be, that there was not proper vetting of it, or that it's a bad business deal going forward? I'm trying to get a handle on this.
There's a very basic concept as taxpayers, and that is the government can't loan, pledge, or give away our tax dollars. Because if they can loan, pledge, or give away our tax dollars, then as taxpayers, we have no protections. This is the kind of situation that constitutional provision is there for. If Jefferson Parish can give $10.3 million away to build a building for Port Orleans, a private commercial operator in Gretna, then they can find $20 million and go give to another business in Kenner, and more money to go give to a business in Metairie. Government is not in the business of giving away millions of dollars, and the taxpayers get nothing back. So my immediate concern is we're giving 10.3 to the brew pub. My larger concern is, why is Jefferson Parish now in the business of giving away millions of dollars for commercial businesses and getting nothing back?
And there's nothing like this has happened before in Jefferson Parish for commercial development, JEDCO, et cetera, none of this?
No, not like this.
Okay. Any final thoughts before we let you go?
No, appreciate being on once again.
All right. Thank you, Kim Chatelain, Jefferson Parish Inspector General. Kim, are you still there?
Yes.
Who owns the building after it's built?
Jefferson Parish.
Jefferson Parish does own the building, so they have that capital asset, right?
They will have the asset. They will not have use of it, and they will have the obligation to maintain it.
But if they wanted to divest themselves of it, could they?
Could they sell the building after it was built?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. That's a really interesting question. They could sell the land before the building was built. If they don't need the land, they could sell the land and somebody else can build the building too.
But I guess
it's an asset that can be sold.
So it would be an asset that the parish, I guess there would be an upside in that the parish would potentially have an asset that would be appreciating in value?
The parish would have an asset that's appreciating in value. It would still be a donation because the parish would not be getting the revenue for its use.
Okay. Thanks. I appreciate your time. 9:33, we'll talk to Joe Marino, former state representative, practicing attorney. He testified for an hour before the Jefferson Parish Council about this project, as I understand it, before it started. 9:33, 27 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 9:40, 20 till 10. Joe Marino joins us, former state representative, practicing attorney, talking about this brew pub thing in Gretna. Joe, I've spent some time talking about this now. I still don't know what the hell is going on. I'm trying to figure it out. I don't know if there's a there or not. tell me what's happening here, because it seems like a lot of politics. And Ms. Chatelain, you're welcome to call back if you want, but I don't understand.
Yeah, please call back. Please call back. Look, good morning, Tommy, and thank you for asking me to give an update on the Kingfish Riverview development. I'm excited that we're about to break the ground. I want to throw that in first before we talk about this investigation, because this is going to be a game-changing Riverview development for the West Bank. When people see it, they're going to go, they're going to lose their minds. They're going to look at this and go, this is a destination to come to in the city of Gretna that the parish owns. I thought when the letter came out from the inspector general, the reason the letter has so many errors and incorrect statements was because she hadn't interviewed anybody. Mm-hmm. But now she started interviewing people, and now she started requesting documents. And I actually went to the council meeting, and I spoke for almost an hour about exactly what this is. This is a state capital outlay project where the state of Louisiana is funding the majority of the project. There is a small part of the project that the parish is going to put up as their local match. That is the commercial, the leasable commercial space. It is all interconnected. And in the end, what happens, and I can't believe she's still saying the same things now. I can't believe she's saying that we're giving away, we're donating money, we're donating assets. I can't believe that that's still happening. What the parish is going to get, so we can be clear, they're investing about $10 million of the money that came down from the American Rescue Plan for Economic Development that Councilman Edwards has the discretion to use in his district, mm-hmm. and he's dedicating that money. That's the only investment the parish is going to have in the process. And then in the end, they get the whole complex. They get the three-level parking garage. They get the commercial leasable space, which is prime real estate. There's also a linear park that's built into it with a outdoor concert space. There's a kiosk. The parish owns all that.
Well, yeah, correct me if I'm wrong. This seems like when you talk about having to maintain it, it's like, Joe, here's the deal, or Tommy, here's the deal. I'm going to give mm-hmm. you this $500,000 home. It's absolutely free, but I got to tell you, you're going to have to maintain it. Well, that seems like a pretty good deal to me.
It's not giving. Okay, so they're trying to spin this into something nefarious. It's an economic development project that these small little groups that are nationally, you might have heard of them.
I mean Jetco, good deal. Good
GNO
deal from,
Inc.
Yeah, good deal from the parish's standpoint, where it's that.
It's a great deal. You're going from a lot, commercial, a flat lot. To you own commercial leasable space, and you have a tenant that we have worked to get with into this space. It's a public-private partnership. This is not good government. This is great. This is smart. It's not just good.
Joe,
everybody recognizes that.
In the time that we have, I want to try to clear this up as much as I can. I asked her if there were any precedents for this. She said not in the parish, but this is the same thing that the Superdome did with the renovation, right?
Lots of different across the country, across our state, you use these economic development corporations to manage and run properties that are owned by the local governments. This is some good government going on at a level that they don't understand, apparently. And even though we try to explain it, they continue to now defend the public letter to the end, and it's laughable to say that the parish doesn't get anything out of this agreement. That is absolutely ridiculous.
So the project is not in jeopardy, is it?
No, that's another thing. What I'm calling this is we're ready to move forward on Kingfish Riverview development, and we are moving forward on it. There was an attempt to stop it and stall it, which, let me just be clear, I'm going to call it like I see it. That's ugly politics. It's political retribution.
Do that,
and
if
then
you will.
Also,
please, Joe, do that. Tell me the backstory behind all of this, if you would, because I know there is a political backstory, and if you don't mind getting into it, I think you could clear everything up if you would.
I've been trying not to. I've been trying about the project.
No, why don't you just get into the political
backstory?
But
I'll tell you what it is.
Do that,
please. I'll tell you what it is.
Please.
All right. A year ago, when this supposedly got on the radar of the IG or Jennifer Van Ranken, it happened to be when Jennifer Van Ranken was running for what was traditionally a West Bank at-large seat. She ran against it. She had opposition from Ricky Templet on the West Bank, and a lot of the West Bank was behind Ricky, and they supported Ricky. And then she called it into question during that election. And then after that, almost a year later, when we're getting ready to break ground, in year three of a project, her friend, the IG, drops a public letter making wild accusations that are unsupported by any investigation. And so all I hear from people everywhere is that this is just political retribution. This is just getting back at the West Bank for not supporting a councilman. And I don't want to spend all the time talking about that, but that it is what it is.
Well, okay. So when you talk about politics, you're talking about different camps, right? That's what we're talking about here?
Yeah.
So what camps are we talking about?
Well, the Jennifer Van Ranken and the West Bank political organizations, the council, Councilman Templet, it was his project.
Ricky Templet, it was his project.
Yeah, he was involved in it. I mean, it was a state project, okay?
So this would be retribution.
But Ricky was the one who was... Mm-hmm.
Okay, to try to pay back, you're saying to try to pay back, or at least to pay back Ricky for the West Bank not supporting the losing candidate in this, and as a result now the IG, because of a relationship with the losing candidate, is attempting to torpedo the whole project or cast aspersions on it?
Yes, and let me just tell you what I saw just recently. I saw that the Attorney General has criticized this investigation, and it's under review, and they have concerns about the timeliness of the complaint and the sufficiency of the investigation conducted. I could tell you that there's something else that's going on here, or that this is really not a good project and I'm trying to cover it up, Tommy. None of that. Mm-hmm. It's a great project, and it's been through every check and review that it's needed to. It's in compliance with the law. And there is no reason to continue to spread misinformation. There is no donation of land. There is no giving away of money. Stop saying that. That's not correct.
So who signed off on this, Ricky? Who's in favor of this? Approach it from that angle.
Well, let me just make a list of who's not in favor of it. Two that I can come to mind right now, and they're the loudest components. The opponents of this. But GEDCO reviewed the project, and they said, yes, this is a great economic development project for Jefferson Parish. GNO Inc. did an economic study on it. They signed off on it as well. There's a quote from GNO Inc. So we're talking about taking a lot that the parish owns and looking for what's the best use of this flat lot that's near the river. Their quote from GNO Inc., redeveloping public assets to achieve economic development goals is a powerful way to foster growth and invest in our community. I mean, we're talking about 55 jobs coming into this, to these businesses, and there's nothing that was done below or behind closed doors. There was no secret deals involved. This has all been following state law, parish ordinances. And again, we are now, how long has this been going on? And the Inspector General cannot point to a single thing to justify her claim that we've donated some land. She put out information that says the parish isn't going to own the garage until 2031. That's absolutely, the parish immediately owns the garage. She's fixing that up. She's saying that we're giving away money to a private entity. We're not giving away money to a private entity. We are taking the money that's in the discretionary fund of Councilman Edwards, using it for a transformational economic project, which it is intended for. And then that's the investment into the big project, which is a capital outlay project, where there's going to be about $28 million worth of money, primarily coming from the state of Louisiana. And then we're going to have this great economic tool that's going to drive more improvements in development, and it happens to be in Gretna. Okay, but it's the parish's project.
Let me read you a couple of texts here, Joe, so you can respond to them. One says, $10 million taxpayer dollars, their private business, the Jefferson Parish, will not get any sales or property tax, and they have to pay to maintain the area. You can't put lipstick on this. That's why we don't trust politicians. Respond to that, please.
Is that from Kim? That sounds like what Kim Chatelain just said.
I have no earthly idea what her phone number is. It's from 6401 or final four digits, but go ahead.
Okay, well, easy. Here we go again. The $10 million that the parish is going to invest is investing in developing and building and owning real estate, prime real estate. How is that not being called an economic benefit to the parish? You're going to own the real estate. It is prime real estate with a river view of the city. It's got multi-level indoor-outdoor seating. The parish fully owns this. It goes from a lot to that with the back behind it, three-level parking garage, with the linear park, and they own all that.
So that would go back to what I said initially about, okay, Tommy, I'm trying to think how I can make this apply, but basically I get the asset, I just have to maintain it, right?
Yes, and it's not, there's not even a note on it. It's not even a note. Now, on the rent, okay, so the rent from the businesses, okay, it goes to JFI, okay? JFI uses the money to maintain and operate the entire complex, and the money that is not used for that, if there is additional money that is in their account for that, it goes to other Jefferson economic development projects. JFI is a nonprofit. All the members of the board are appointed by Jefferson Parish. They have oversight. Jefferson Parish has oversight. And it goes to more economic development projects on the West Bank. That's where it goes. It doesn't go people. It's a nonprofit. But these nonprofits are very, very common. And they're smart government when you want to interact and move faster and do CMAR projects, construction management at risk. That's what this project is, the way the parish is doing it. And it's a great project, and it's a great way to do a project.
So let me wrap it up this way, Joe. As I understand it here, the books are wide open. The process is wide open. Liz Merle, whomever, and although Liz Merle is not saying the attorney general, she's going to look at your project. She's saying she's going to look at, or the project, she's going to look at the inspector general. You guys are wide open. This has been thoroughly vetted. Come look at it, investigate whatever you want. Accurate?
I am getting all of the records that I can from the state because I'm not the rep anymore. I have to do a public record request. And I want to put them all in her hand and say, I've already explained it to you at the council meeting. This is the capital outlay project, but I'm going to hand you the documents so you can read them again. But what she's trying to do at this point, according, this is my opinion, the inspector general is trying to do is trying to make the facts of her investigation, which is ongoing, look like her letter. And that's just not how you do. That's an abuse of her office to throw out accusations and then investigate them. Because you're bringing a lot of people's reputation into question, and that's not fair to the people or the project. And that's, you know, I mean, I take offense to it. I truly do.
Meanwhile, the project continues on, right?
The show goes on.
And you say investigate, look into it, do whatever you want. There's not a there. Accurate?
And write another letter saying you were wrong.
All right. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate your time. We'll take a break. Talk to Newell when we come back on WWL.